Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, this is Stephanie Campbell with Blog Talk Radio, and yesterday I had a horrible, horrible sore throat, and I didn't think I'd be able to pull this on, but I guess that's anyway, I guess it's that Motown magic. Today we're going to be talking to a legend, William Mickey Stevenson, and he's just written a wonderful book, and it's called Motown's First A&R Man Presents the A&R Man. And since Mickey was the first A&R man at Motown, he was responsible for picking the artist, picking the musicians known as the Funk Brothers, and the conductors like Gil Askey. So, without further ado, I want to let you know that we have the legend on the line, and I want to know, Mickey, are you there?
I am here, and you sound wonderful. So whatever was wrong is gone, because you sound wonderful.
And the hits just keep on coming. thank you. Anyway, one thing I want to let you know as we chat 90 minutes, this book, it's got to be, I mean, okay, we've read all the Motown books about who recorded who and this one wanted their money and this one slept with this one or this one wrote this song, but your book is great because it talks about everything that we don't know behind the scenes. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I want you, well, actually, here's what I want you to do. I'm going to ask you some questions, and I want you to answer them to the best of your ability, which you can. And the reason I'm so excited to talk to you is because you don't pull any punches. You don't beat around the bush. You tell it just like it is. So I want to start off asking you, well, actually, let me tell you this. When I read these books, usually you'll hear about, you know, I grew up in this town, 1935, 1940. My mother was XYZ. And I normally don't like reading that type of stuff, but your book, I really enjoyed it because I loved hearing about Kitty Brown Gal Stevenson. And she sang, she was with the orchestra, and she didn't pick up any welfare checks. She paid her own way. Tell us a little bit about Kitty Brown Gal.
Well, that's my mom, and she was unbelievable. She was proud that she could say to us she didn't smoke or drink or curse. So,
ooh.
And kept us going to church constantly. I mean, that was one thing I did not like to do, would get up early Sunday morning and go to church. But it was absolutely necessary in my house. But when it comes down to music and teaching and things like that, she was adamant. You had to rehearse, study constantly. And her line was something like, okay, if you don't get it where it'll come naturally, you're not working on it hard enough. So she had a plan for everything. She was a wonderful talent and a good writer. And we had an opportunity not too long ago to have some people from London call us and say, we have songs by your mom. And it was turned out to be about 12 songs that I never heard of. And they sent them.
Wow.
That they were selling them for like $50 or something like that, a copy. And I said, what? How is this possible? And when I checked them out, sure enough, there were songs that I never heard of before. And they sent them, and we played them. And my son, Novel, and Brian, they started listening to them and said, is that mom? That's your grandma? Is that my grandma? Yes, that's her. She was wonderful. Absolutely.
Okay, were these actual 45s or acetates?
These were the original vinyls. You know, in that day, there was not, the 45s was out. They weren't there yet.
Oh, 78s?
Huh?
78s?
Yes, yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Isn't that incredible?
Well, you know how these Brits are. They can hunt down. These people can hunt these things down. I don't know how they do it, but they can do it. They can do it, though. I'm assuming that because your mother didn't have, like, any hit records on the charts, because of her talent, is that how she was able to get all the gigs that she got and the word just got out about her?
Yes, yes. Well, she worked with, like, the Sweethearts of Rhythm Band, a Todd Road Band, big orchestras in those days, and she was performing with them as their singer. And what happened was we had a club in Detroit called the Flame Show Bar. I think I wrote about it in my book, yeah.
Yes.
Flame Show Bar. Now, this was like the main club that all the great acts would come in and perform at. And my mother was like a regular there. And it happened that Dinah Washington came in to perform. I like to have the regulars come on first, 20 minutes or 30 minutes. But they had my mom on in front of Dinah Washington. And because my mom tore the place apart. So when the show was over, after Dinah did her part and was over, she sat down with the manager, and my mom was sitting there. The next time you bring me in here, I don't want to see no dog acts. And I don't want to see no Kitty Brown, Gail Stevens.
Okay. Oh, well, that's funny.
They became friends after that.
Okay. All right. And then, unfortunately, your mom passes away, and that's a, you know, a big hit to your family. I understand that. That'd be a big hit to anyone's family. And, you know, life goes on. But I want to ask you, I want to paraphrase this. I know there's a lot in between, but how did you actually meet Berry Gordy?
I met Berry Gordy at the barbershop in Detroit. We had, in those days, everybody was having their hair processed and everything with the waves in it, you know, the waves that could rock a boat.
Okay, and the conks, yeah.
Yeah, the conks. Everybody had to go to this one spot because we only had one good spot in the neighborhood, and that was Benny Mullen's House of Styles.
Oh.
Aretha's father would go, and all the people from that end would go. We'd all go to the same place. And Benny had a habit of keeping you in the building, like having you in conversation with somebody or on the phone, and so he can keep everybody in the shop so he can get all the money. He didn't want nobody
right.
to So he would hook you up with different people. So he had told Berry about me, and he had told me about Berry because we were calling at different times. So at this particular time, we happened to be there together, and that was perfect for Benny. He said, okay, he wasn't ready for either one of us to get our hair done. So he said,
okay.
This is the guy I was telling you about, Mickey Stevenson. He said, Mickey, this is Berry. He's the one that wrote that music for Jackie Wilson you like. And while I was saying, oh, wow. And I said, oh, you wrote for Jackie? And he said, yeah. And while I'm talking, Benny goes over to his jukebox, drop a nickel in, and played the Jackie Wilson's record. One of my favorite songs. I said, oh, man, that's... I said, you working with him now? And Berry said, yeah. He said, but I heard about you, and you're a songwriter, but you got a lot of, you know, the musicians in the city, and they seem to have a lot of respect for you. He said, we got to get together and talk. I got to go back and finish the album, and when I come back in town, we got to get together. And I said, okay. I said, now, where are you going? He said, I'm going to finish some songs with Jackie. So I said, oh, well, I got a couple of songs you can take with you. He smiled, he had a little grin, he brought on his face. And I said, I get him to you. He said, no, I'll talk to you when I get back. So we had a little conversation with, that was our first meeting, right to the, we talked all the way under the dryer. We kept talking. And I woke up, he was gone, but because he went under first. And that's how we met. And when he came back, which was about 4 or 5 months later, maybe a little bit longer, we met at his house. He called me and said, look, man, you got to get over. Let's have a talk. And I sat down with him. Well, because when I walked in, he had lived in a little what we call fabulous apartment. You know, those ghetto fabulous where you had to press the button and grab it.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Well, that's where he was living. And I come in. I'm down the hall with him talking. He was the last apartment in the hallway. And he's standing there in his shorts on the phone. And I'm saying, he said, kiddo, come on in. And he's talking on the phone. I'm waiting. I don't see no piano. I don't see nothing. And I said, I'm thinking, this is the Berry Gordy that's writing for Jackie Wilson, a big hit. And I'm saying to myself, boy, this guy is cheap. You know? And he said to me, okay, I heard your songwriter, too, and everything. Let me hear some of your songs. But now I'm thinking, this is it. This is going to be my big chance of being the next Jackie Wilson. I'll pull out my
You want
song.
To be a singer? Okay.
I start singing. And I sang one, I sang two. If I got to the fifth song, he said, you got any more? I said, yeah. He said, well, let me hear. Six, seven, eight. When I finished, he said, you got some pretty good songs there. Oh, my head's big now. I can see myself. I say, now I know which song we should come with first on my record. You say, on your record first. Your songs are good, but you know, your voice, it ain't happening. I say, what you mean it ain't happening? He say, your voice. Can I say this? He said, your voice is for shit. Oh, man, my heart was broke. I was ready to go. I grabbed all my music off the floor. I'm heading out the door. He said, where you going? I said, man, I don't need this. He said, no. If you're going to be in charge of the A&R for my company, you got to be honest. And I said, A&R, what's that? He said, artist and rep track. You're going to run the music department. I said, wait a minute. You going to hire me to run it? I'm going to be in charge of the music? He said, everything. I said, wait a minute. Can I record anybody I want? He said, you're in charge. But you got to be honest. If it ain't good, we don't want to put it out. I said, going back to my first talk, can I record myself? He said, same thing. Got to be honest. So I said, I think about it. I'm pretty good. I said, how much you paying? He said, $5 a day. $5 a day? Yay. And he smiled and he said, and all the chili you can eat. I said, wait a minute. I didn't come here to get no chili and burger and a $5. Man. No. I'm walking away. On my way out to Stephanie, I'm down the hall, leaving, and he's standing there in the door watching me walk away. And I remember my mom said, if you want to do something and you believe in it, you got to go after it. It's not going to come to you. You got to spend some time at it. You got to see if you can develop. It's up to you. And I stopped in the hallway. I turned around, and I walked back down. I said, when do I start? And he said, you already started. We shook hands right there. That's how it started.
Whoa.
Okay, so now you've started. You're the A&R man. Now, before I ask you about the auditions, tell people who are listening and people who are going to listen later when the show is archived, because most of them don't know. Although you did a heck of a lot more, what does an A&R man do?
An A&R man, is the title, of course, is Artist and Repertoire. An A&R man has to bring the artists, get the writers, and producers, the musicians, pull it all together and record the best material you can get your hands on that artist. That's what his job is all about.
Okay, now when you were doing auditions and you finally got all the Funk Brothers together and the artist, I read in the book, someone told you that, Mickey, you were American Idol before American Idol was American Idol. In other words, you were Simon and Paula and Randy and whoever else all rolled up into one. How did the people find out about these auditions, and exactly how bad were they, some of them?
Well, the auditions were, once we started happening, and for me, I had to get more writers, more artists, more producers. You know, regular auditions we had at the company. Start off with a few. And then the better we got and the more the public learned about us, the more they came. And it was like we would do like 20, 35, 40 people. I mean, on a daily basis, they would. It was amazing. It got to be like a line of people. And they came home. And, you know, it would be so that I would try to find ways of getting out of the auditions, like get out the building, because I got tired of listening to all these people. But they would catch me sometime in the hallway or down the stairs or out the back door. And they said, you know, I come to audition. And I said, well, audition's on Saturday. Yeah, but you got to hear me. And I would say to them, I felt everybody had opportunities. If they could catch me, I had to listen. And I would say, okay, you're a singer, right, or what? Say, I'm a singer. Okay, start singing. They say, right here? I say, right here. And out here in the back, in the lot? Yes, right now. And if they wouldn't sing, I'd start singing, oh, baby, I need you, like that. And I'd say, see, if I can sing, you can sing. I'd say, now, if you can't sing like that, come back when you can do that. Goodbye. I'd leave. Not some, I would say, let me hear you sing. They sang right on the spot. I said, wow. Or you're a writer. Let me hear your song. They tell me. But the bottom line is, the people came with hope. And, you know, when you see people with that look on their face and that kind of feeling, you got to deal with it. And auditions were not something special to me. I mean, notice I didn't know how to do it. I developed how to audition people. And at once I was kind of hard about it. And as I worked with them and saw the passion in their faces and all the passion in their music and stuff, I had to back up and listen sometimes to the whole song when I really wanted to cut it off after the first two words.
Okay.
But I had to give them respect. And it got to be more and more. So I was judging everything, listening to everything. And it kept building. And that's how it happened, and that's how it kept developing. And I got better as I went along. You with me?
Yes, I'm here, and you learned as well as they did, which brings me to this. When it came to auditions, you know, a lot of people, when they audition, whether they're singing or job interview or what have you, they're very relentless. And Diana Ross happens to be that kind of person, laser focused. I'll get to her in maybe 30 minutes. This really shocked me in the book. When Martha Reeves became your secretary, I was really surprised at how persistent and organized she was. I had no idea Martha was that relentless as far as getting into Motown. Tell me a little bit about that.
Oh, Martha was one of the kind of people that would come every day. I mean, I'm loaded with girl singers, right? So I don't want any more female singers, but not right at the time. I mean, I got enough to work with. And here's Martha coming to audition. Well, after a couple of auditions with her, I knew she could sing, but come on. I'm trying to find ways not to deal with any more female singers at this time.
Uh-huh.
But she had gotten so familiar with my secretary and all that till she could. I would come in and she'd be already in the audition room sitting there waiting. And I'm saying, Martha, how'd you get in here? And she'd laugh and all that. One day, and I'm talking about Martha would come every day. One day I come to my office in the morning, kind of early, and when I get past the audition room into my regular office space, Martha was on my phone. And she was messages, calls coming from me. And I looked at her, I said, oh, I'm going to straighten this girl out. She done lost her mind. So I said, I stood there because she was in the middle of a conversation. I didn't want to cut right in. I wanted to wait till she finished. While I'm standing there, I'm listening to her talk. Well, Mr. Stevenson won't be in for a while, blah, 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 blah. And what's your name and what's your number? Oh, okay. Did I tell him anything particular about this call? She's writing this all down, and I'm listening to her. When she finished, and I was getting ready to say something, she tore off about five pieces of paper and handed them to me. She said, these are the calls that came in right away. And I think a couple of them you ought to get right back to. And I looked at the paper, and I saw one I should get right back at. I said, well, call this guy right back. She called him. We had a conversation. When it was over, I said, Martha, you're pretty good at this. She said, yeah. I said, now, I don't want an artist right now. But I tell you what, I'll give you a job. She said, what kind of job? I said, I'll give you a job as a secretary because my girl is about to leave in about a week. And I didn't
right.
know they had hooked up. I said, I'll give you a job. You can be my secretary for about a week. She said, I'll work for you, but not as your secretary. I'll be your assistant. I said, wait a minute. Well, you want me to do it? I said, well, you're doing pretty good. Okay, I said, I'll give you a assistant. We'll try it for a little while. And if it works out, we'll figure out something. I said, now, I stay late at night. She said, no, I'll stay as long as you stay. And you don't have to pay me no extra money. I said, but sometimes I don't leave till 12, 1 o'clock in the morning. She said, if you're here, I'm here. I said, wow, to myself, this girl ain't fooling around. So I said, okay, you got a job. That's how we started. And she was very good. She could handle the musicians. She could handle the people calling. She wasn't excited about the stars that came in and the artists that, you know, from different companies want to come over and get with us. She was very smooth. Well, most girls would always get excited about somebody coming in.
Or get flustered, right.
And she was not that. And I said, Martha, each time I keep kind of raising money up and all that, and every time she'd bring contracts for me to sign, she'd stick her contract in there. And I'd be saying, I said, what is this? I said, Martha, I ain't signing you with no, that ain't happening. And one day she finally got me. She kept doing this. I looked down one day and here's, I got about taking a four talk to somebody, no, one of the groups, and there's her contract. I said, okay, Martha. She said, look, I'm not getting overtime for work. You might as well sign that contract. I said, I think I better because you're going to drive me crazy. So I signed the contract. I had no intentions of recording her, though. I just wanted to keep her because she was so good. And we stayed that way for a while. And she would do background and all that kind of stuff. One evening, Marvin Gaye and I and Abby Jo Hunter, we were in the studio writing a song for Kim Weston. And we finished the tune. We had cut the track. And so Abby Jo said to me, "Well, man, you know, Kim sings very powerful, and this song needs a lighter sound to it." I said, "Yeah. Well, I got to get her to sing it like we hear it." He said, "What you going to do?" I say, "I'm going to get Martha to come down here and do a demo so Kim can learn this." And then I say, "I'll kill two birds with one stone. I'll record Martha.
Right.
You can see I'm working with her, and I'll have a demo. Give it to Kim." So they said, "Oh, man, great idea." Of course, Martha was there. I said, "Martha," she comes downstairs. I said, "We want you to learn this song." So Marvin Gaye said to her, he said, "Now, we just want you to sing it, you know, like you do. She said, "Well, what is it for?" We said, "It's a demo." She said, "Okay." She's wanting to do whatever to get behind that microphone. So we worked it out, and we put her on. She got on the microphone, and she started doing the tune. When she finished the song, it was real quiet in the control room. Marvin Gaye looked at me. Abby Jo looked at him. Just sat there looking at each other. I said, "What you think?" And they said, "We think the same thing you think, William R. That sounds like a hit record." I say, I know. So Marvin Gaye said, "Well, you the man around here. What you going to do?" I said, "What do you mean, what am I going to do?" He said, "You said that the best tune on the best artist, that's the one that's going out. Those were your words. We've been living around that on those words ever since we've been here." And Ivy Jo Hunter said to me, and he never cut his hair. Ivy Jo decided he would not cut his hair until he had a hit record.
Okay.
And Ivy Jo said, "Man, get a haircut." I said, "What are you talking about?" I said, I got to figure out who's going to do this song." And Ivy Jo said, "Ain't no nothing to figure out. We already hit a song. It was a hit." I said, "Let me work this thing out." So now I got to figure out how to keep this tune on Martha, because it was absolutely wonderful.
So Kim wouldn't get upset.
Now Kim getting upset, who at the time was my girlfriend, so I had a real problem. Marvin Gaye said, "I wouldn't want to be in your shoes, brother." Wait, I worked it out. And I can give the details, but it's all in the book how I worked it out.
Yeah, it's okay, go ahead.
I came back and I told Ivy Jo that next day, I said, "Ivy Jo, you go get a haircut."
You know, what I find, I'll tell you something else I found interesting, and it's on page 77, if anybody doubts it. I was under the impression as a fan that Holland Dozier Holland or Clarence Paul or whoever the producer was would put the charts down and the singers would sing and the backgrounds would sing and then cut the record. Now, I'm looking here and it says, if they don't know the lyrics, I would stop the session. This is you.
Yeah.
And tell them, don't waste my money, which is not your money. It was your budget.
You're right.
And they would call you ill-deuced, jive-ass Mickey, badass Mickey. You had all these horrible names because people, you know, you were talking about, it's my money, but it was really your budget money. Here's a question I have for you. How were you part of these sessions if you were telling these people they need to remember their lyrics? I thought it was just Holland Dozier Holland or whomever.
Oh, I walked the halls. Listen, when I booked all the studio time, every producer up in that studio to do his product had to come through my office. A lot of people had to keep up with the songs they were recording, who they were recording on. All the paperwork had to be done in advance, right?
Right.
So we keep up with the records. And so I was, as the A&R director, I would have put Holland and Dozier to Holland with the artist, or Marvin, or Smokey, I'd put them with that artist to finish that product. So we had meetings. I had to have this product in the meeting for the next week or the next month. I had to have this product finished. So I knew every song that was being recorded and who was recording it and how long you had that music. Say if you were the writer and the producer and you had, say, Marvin Gaye or, say, the Vandellas, and you gave them the song, you gave them the lyrics, they're supposed to go and learn the words. In the meantime, we'd go cut the track, shall we say, the music track. The Funk Brothers would cut the track.
Right.
And the girls would, or the artists would come in and sing. When they came to the studio and they're stumbling over the words and they don't know the lyrics, I'm standing there looking at them and I'm saying, wait a minute. This song and this track for a week. Do it. Get out of here. Go get that song together. Next producer, come on. I go like that.
But did they know, did these artists know, excuse me, did these artists know that they had to answer to you? Or did they think they had to answer to the producer, or they knew?
Oh, they knew they had to answer to me in the end. And the producers had to answer to me. Because I would say, Brian, Eddie, didn't you rehearse them on that song before you played it? And if they started stumbling around, I'd say, don't you think you better go in the room and work that out? Next producer, come on in here.
And so you were talking to Holland Dozier Holland like this, and at the time they were like, you know, on the throne of producers, but it didn't matter. You could talk to them any way you wanted to.
But always with respect to the fact that you know I have to have this product ready, and you know it's got to be ready for the meeting. And if I don't have it for the meeting, I got a problem with Barry. You're not going to give me a problem. But like that. And you're going to have it ready, and you got two more acts. Now, you're going to slow this one down? Well, you're going to do that with each act? I need three songs from you. Where are they? So they knew not to mess around with me.
Okay, so explain this to me. If the product wasn't ready, in other words, if they didn't know the lyrics and you had to go call next producer to come in, if the time was being used up improperly, did that come out of your budget?
Well, yes. It wouldn't come out of my budget because I wouldn't let it be used up improperly. When I first started off, I was kind of didn't know that people would be a little lackadaisical in doing things. As I moved along, I found out that it would. If you're a producer and you're producing a tune on one of the artists and you weren't ready, I would bring the next producer in. Now, you may not get back to the studio for a week. So now it behooves you not to fool around because I'm not going to hold up the rest of it and wait on you. I had you know, 7 or 8 producers, 13 artists. You could find yourself waiting around a long time.
Right. And I'll tell you something else that was interesting. Even with the studio, the different artists that you picked, I can remember listening to a Motown compilation. This was a couple of years ago. And I know that you had signed people like Barbara McNair and Billy Eckstein. You want to get the, I guess you would call it the Supper Club crowd. Oh. Remember this song by the Supremes, Ask Any Girl?
Ask Any Girl. I think so.
Okay. Well, anyway, on this compilation, there was Tony Martin. You know, he was married to Sid Charisse. We all know that. And I heard this man singing, Ask Any Man. And I'm like, what the heck is this? And I said, this is Tony Martin. What's he doing on Motown? And what I wanted to ask you was, whose idea was it to get, I don't want to say Supper Club crowd, but that's what it was at the time. Whose idea was it to get these people on Motown?
Barry. Barry, you know, once we started rolling, and Barry said, we got to diversify. We got to get some, really wanted to, we had two things going. We wanted to get more pop airplay, so we had to find different angles to make that happen. And we wanted to draw other audiences to our material.
Mm-hmm.
So what's a better way than to get pop artists to be on the line, to get more pop airplay and open the door to get some of our other product through the door? We had to think of different ways, and this is the stuff that people wouldn't understand. Let's battle of getting black music on across was not an easy battle. It was always oppositions, and we had to be conscious of that. And to make that happen, we had to find different ways of getting past the wall that has always been up, and still up today, of course, but not the same. So we were some of the innovators of breaking down some of those walls, and that was one of the methods that we used. Are you following me?
Yes.
Okay. So when I did Tony Martin in New York, I was in love with Sid Charisse. He was incredible. And to watch him sing the the different songs, trying to get one that might be satisfactory for us. It was a hard job because he always had that, you know, that Broadway kind of voice concept.
Exactly.
Never wanted to change it. And I'm saying, this is, you got to be a little more natural. Imagine me telling him how to be natural to sing. That didn't come over too good. You understand? But he did the best he could do after about four or five drinks. So we finally got it where he would listen and do the best he could do. But we had a reason for that. And we signed a few artists like that. And none of them ever really took. Closest thing that was good for us, of course, was Billy Eckstein, which was right in the pocket, but he would jump right in there and make it happen. You know what I'm saying? And that was
right.
Good.
But with Six Degrees of Separation, there was a connection. Billy Eckstein, Four Tops.
Exactly. Exactly. And that was a good thing. Very good. And it was wonderful for me when I met the Four Tops. Since you came up, they were like brothers to me. And, from the beginning, that I wrote about it in a book, it was like overwhelming that I had an opportunity to them singing an amateur show, and then years later signing them to Motown was just one great thing for me. It really was overwhelming.
And if I remember correctly in the book, Duke said, well, I'm paraphrasing here, it was divine intervention or something like that. That they were able to meet you, and you didn't have any difficulty with the Four Tops signing the contracts. Is that correct?
None. It was amazing because when I saw them, like I said, I saw them when I was on furlough, and I saw them doing an amateur show with my favorite Jackie Wilson as the star of the show. We had our Warfield Theater was like the Apollo, where they'd have amateur shows, you get a movie, that, and then you have a main star would come in and. Oh, and anyway, I saw them there, and they were incredible. And I heard their song, and I remember it till the very day. And then I said, boy, these guys are going to be. And they were kind of inspirational for me to get into this business, really.
Mm-hmm.
So when I saw them again years later in New York, they were performing with Billy Eckstein at a nightclub. But they had changed the name from the Four Tops from the Four Ames, which was their first name, to the Four Tops. So when I saw Billy Eckstein and the Four Tops, I had no idea it was a group. But I walked in and I heard these guys singing. I said, oh my God, there they are. And they were doing it. And so I got them and I said, show was over. I said, come here, man. You guys got to come with me, go back to Detroit. I'm going to make you a star. And they said, who are you, man? I said, I'm Mickey Stevens with Motown. They said, yeah, man, we sang jazz. And I said, man, you guys sang songs. I want to hear that jazz stuff. You guys sing. And I said, I heard you sing rock and roll and all that. They said, where? Then I sang their song for them at the Apollo. I mean, in Detroit at the Warfield. They went crazy. How could I remember that? And that's how they stayed with me. Anyway.
They great harmonies.
Yeah. They came
please tell me, please tell me as a fan that the Four Tops weren't late for their sessions.
No, the Four Tops were. They were pretty good. They were pretty good.
Yeah, they seem very professional.
They were pretty good. They was they were on sessions and they were they knew all the lyrics. But I mean they were professional. They were.
But they didn't complain a lot, correct?
Say it again.
They didn't. They weren't known as complainers.
Oh no. They were overwhelmed because remember I said that they were singing as an amateur group. And then running around doing little gigs, and all of a sudden there was Billy Eckstein in some great spots, but never being seen, never being, you know, brought out special, just made a background. So they were always there and always in the background, and this was an opportunity for them, and they took total advantage of it. They made every rehearsal, every audition, I mean, every, we had a artist development department that I made every artist. Had to go to that development department before they could even go in the studio. Four Tops was on time. They were wonderful. They were the easiest act ever to work with.
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is not only were the Four Tops interesting to work with and easy to work with, I noticed that when they perform, people are happy. They're probably one of the few groups I've seen where everybody's happy all of the time when they see them sing. It's almost like their happiness protrudes out to the audience.
Very good. Very good observation. And I tell you what, that's one of the only groups in history that I know of that never broke up. They stayed together.
It was only through death that it happened,
right.
Unfortunately.
Even when they were mad at each other, they would still be together.
I can't even imagine the four, and I know we're all human, but I just can't even imagine those guys getting mad at each other.
Oh, they can get mad at each other. Oh, boy, you know how guys can get mad. Not about music, always about something else. It had nothing to do with
music. Oh, right, they're like real life things. But, however, I used to read normal, and this brings me to another, you talk about the Chitlin' Circuit or people working in the clubs. I remember reading all of these things, and very little known things, because nobody really knew them that well on the outside. I mean, you knew him. As a fan, I knew very little about Herman Griffin. However, I read about you. You have all kinds of interesting stories in this book, but the one that stood out with me is when Mary Wells was performing. You were going to have Eddie Holland come on stage and wear this nice white tie and tails or a white suit, whichever. And Herman Griffin comes out there and you're orchestrating the band. And while she's singing, she's looking behind her and he's doing flips. I mean, actual flips and backflips in his tie and tails. And I'm sitting here thinking to myself, no wonder this man got Mary Wells in trouble and told her to leave Motown. If he's going to do this, he's not going to be able to run her career.
He wanted his career. He wanted to be the star. You know how that happens. You know, the girls and the guys really want to climb up and be the main guy.
Mm-hmm.
Herman Griffin was out there. That guy was really out there. And, I mean, and he had always had this big grin on his face like, I got you. You know what I mean?
So are you saying that he was with Mary, I don't want to say user, but he wanted to be with her in order to further his career?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, because, see, I knew Herman Griffin before I knew Motown. I used to, for a living, I would do songs for you if you wanted to sing. I would put your song together on some music or give you a demo. And Herman Griffin came to me, and his manager was a mailman. And the mailman said, I got this guy that I think is going to be a big star, and we need some music. And I had my little one-room apartment and the piano and all that, and that was my hustle. And they said,
okay,
do a song on him. And he came in like he was a big star. I mean, he walked in my place. I mean, his head was cocky, and he had all this crazy suit and wild shoes, and he come in. And I said, give me a song. And he's jumping and rolling in my hot rod car. And that's what he said. I said, wait a minute, man. I thought he was going to be a blues singer. No, he was all over the place. So I wrote that song for him. I laid it out for him. And, of course, it didn't go nowhere. So I knew Herman then. Years later, I meet him again very well. Well, he hadn't changed because he wanted to be a star then. You follow?
Okay. Mm-hmm.
But nobody would take him on. So the other singer, he could be a star. That was his game plan.
Mm-hmm.
Me, but that was him. He had a chance to get back at
him. Was Mary Wells so in love with this man that it overshadowed common sense when it came to staying with Motown?
Well, she had a right to be. You know, when people fall in love, they love can take control, as we all have been there. And, yeah, it was more important to her to keep the relationship. And I was not happy with it personally, but that was as a business part. But I could see the look on her face whenever he upset her. She loved him.
But when 20th Century Fox, and I forget the dollar amount, offered her money to come to, you know, their label and to leave Motown, did you, in retrospect, do you look back and think, well, that's a lot of money. A lot of people would have done that, or they didn't see the importance of what Motown had to offer in the longevity.
It's a combination of both. I can see the money part. What they didn't know, Herman had sold them a bill of goods. In other words, we had built Mary up, and so if you didn't know, you would think the automatic machine. where she was not like. In producing Mary, you had to really work with her. So if you didn't know how to work with her as a producer, you were not going to get the quality out of her that needed to be done. And Herman,
yeah,
can do that.
In the book, and this is unbeknownst to me, in the book you mentioned that Mary was a good singer, but she needed a special producer, a.k.a.
Yeah.
Smokey. But you said something, I'm trying to remember, I'm paraphrasing here, you said that her voice had to be overdubbed in order to get the effect?
Yes. In other words, we had to do a lot of overdubbing to get the right, to make the song come out to the best that you could get. You had to punch her in and dub in a few more times. She couldn't just go there and just sing right through a song. And a lot of artists can't do that. Let me make that clear. Let's just say the more times she overdubbed, the better the song became for Mary. Are you with
okay.
me?
Okay. I'm with
now,
you, but it was not for a lack of talent. That's just the way she had to be recorded.
Exactly. And if you couldn't get that out of her, or you wouldn't pay any attention to that, when you let her go through the song and you played it back, you heard it could be better. So you had to reach and pull those moments out. That meant you had to be a producer that knew how to make that happen. Herman was not that kind of producer. He would not be singing songs like "Rockin' and Rollin' in my Rock."
I'm sorry, that's just so funny. Oh, you know what? A lot of people who work for Motown have said that, and I know it goes into more detail in your book, but a lot of people who work for Motown have said that Motown did not participate in Paola. However, on page 141, DJs were demanding gifts. How do you answer the Paola question now?
There was no company in America that didn't find, have some form of Paola going on. Like yesterday, today, and tomorrow. No politician, no bank, no nothing without paying somebody. Make myself real clear.
Okay. I just wanted to hear from the horse's mouth, because I'm sure you know that there have been people who said, oh, Motown wasn't involved in Paola. And at first I thought, well, maybe that means not money. Maybe that means other things, like your book says, like women and gifts.
Bring what you may, they were not going to just put your records on because your name was Motown. That happened after you became hot enough that it would behoove them to put you on, because we'll go to the station right next to you. It took time to get to that.
Okay, but it was more than just Paola as far as getting the records on the air. They had to stay on the air. And I'm trying to remember. I can't remember right now, but you explained how the records stayed. They were like rotating between 30 and 40 records an hour or something like that, or a day.
Yeah. You're right. Uh-huh.
And then yeah. If people called in, we want to hear that record again. That's how they would determine.
Oh, yeah. Well, that and Paola helps determine. But,
okay. Excuse me. Would you like to answer the question about the mob or no comment?
Mob? Not a mob. We didn't have a mob problem. We had a
okay.
racial.
You had a what?
We had a racial problem. Black, white radio owners, that problem. The problem that still exists today, only we broke down some of the walls. We had the same problem in records in that time as blacks had in the movie business.
That makes a lot of sense. That makes a lot of sense.
It had nothing to do with Bob. It had something to do with your color and who you are.
Which brings me to Barney Ellis. He was the VP of sales. His group was called the Magnificent Seven. And according to what you said, if I remember correctly, that group consisted of Arabs and Jews and all kinds of races. Is that another way you broke the barriers as far as record personnel?
Exactly. And Barney's job, and I love Barney because he came to say, I want my records played. Motown was just coming to concern, and he didn't want to hear nothing from nobody. And being white and Jewish and strong and mean, he meant every word he said. See? And if you didn't put his records on, if you didn't pay as a distributor, he would bring a truck over to your office, your building, and remove our product.
Oh, my goodness.
In a truck. And take it to the guy next door to you. if you give him a hard time and stand there and ask you, you got a problem with this? You follow what I'm saying? So what about gangsters and this, that, and the other? It was about, it was a racial thing. As you know, in the industry, up until we had, people break down the walls, we were, maids and servants. That's all we could do. And you know that's not true. But
that's not true.
Right? Now, it was the same problem with records. Pop stations. Listen, black stations would go off the air. They'd come on for a few hours and off by 12 o'clock. So how many records could they play? How many companies could be in there? You know? So that was back in the day where we had to get some more airplay, some more time. And Barney Ayers was kind of that would make that happen. Where they would look at him, white boys looking at Barney, saying, okay, we'll do it for you. And Barney said, okay, how you do it, as long as you do it.
I know you make light of this, you don't make light of it, but I know you joke about it, but supposedly this song helped people to function. Oh, we are a swinging company working hard from day to day. I don't know the tune, but did you have to sing this? Pardon me?
With you five more unity, then at Hitsville, USA. Very good. You sung the melody right, too. I love that.
But, I mean, this, the first time I heard that song was on Motown 25, but did you guys have to, get together and sing the song? How did that happen as far as you all singing the song?
Oh, we had to sing that song every meeting. When we had a company meeting, that was our opening song. We had to, that was the song that kind of brought us together in the meetings. Sit there and sing that tune into the meeting. But that put the spirit in the same place. You know what was, I think I wrote about this in detail, that when that song first came along, I was saying, ridiculous, I ain't got time to be singing it. You know, I was always trying to get it on, no matter what, right? And I said, I ain't got time for this stuff, and this is stupid. And when we started singing it, and I started feeling the sensitive and the emotion around the people around me, and I said, wow, this is a tide that binds everybody together. So we became proud of it. And everybody that came to our company meeting from outside, every DJ, every other producer, television person, radio person, personality that would come and see how Motown was functioning, because they were all shocked at how this company, Indy, that made automobiles, not music, was growing so phenomenal, for the curiosity of how it is. But when they walk in and sit in one of our meetings and hear this whole company sing that song with pride, they got the picture.
Wow. You know, I'm going to skip a little bit past the A&R stuff, because this is something that affected you directly. Excuse me, my voice. I'm trying to bear with it. Okay. How did you feel, and I'm paraphrasing because there's so much in this book, problems with HDH were coming around, and so you figured in your mind Eddie might want to leave the company. So they come to you and they tell you, Barry tells you, we're going to make Eddie the head of A&R, and we're going to make you the president of something else. And you knew that Eddie wasn't scouting for any new talent. Page 177.
Mm-hmm.
How did you feel? Or what was going on in your mind when Barry didn't want Eddie to leave, so he knew he had to give him some kind of position?
Well, I felt hurt, of course, because I had, in my mind, I had put this area to a level that it was running like a well-oiled machine. And I love that. And I could see where I could even do more. I don't know if you area, but I've time that came up, I had brought in choreographers, other kind of musicians, not so much for sessions, but for live shows, and I was finding other people to do other great things. And so I was really out of my area of A&R. I was in the areas, and for that I felt comfortable because I had the A&R department running very smoothly.
Right.
So for me to let it go, or for Barry to change it, was very uncomfortable for me. It's like taking me out of my comfort zone. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't so much the job. It was the people and the place that I was holding. Very uncomfortable, and that's very uncomfortable.
Did it take you a long time to get over it, or you're the kind of person that you can just stand up and, you know, throw it off your shoulder and just say next?
Well, not quite a next. I had to take some time because every time I walked in and was asked questions about the same job, the phone would ring. William R., what do we do about this? William R., that's not working over there. How do we handle this? Well, now I'm not there, but I couldn't let go because they wouldn't allow me to let go, the producers and the writers and the artists, because Eddie was not that kind of person. That was not his thing. So he didn't look at it the same way. He looked at it,
mm-hmm.
in my opinion, as a step up to get more money, his talent that him and his brothers were putting out. And they were putting out great talent. Let me make that perfectly clear. Holland Dozier Holland, in my opinion, was at the time some of the greatest producers in the world. And their records proved it. You know, a number of number one records. That's incredible. Sometimes,
right.
So they deserve the right to feel that way. Let me put it that way. They deserve
mm-hmm.
that. But I think my position, and this is my personal opinion, of an A&R man was not that kind of, like I wasn't an Eddie Holland. I'm a writer and producer, but I was not a writer and producer like Holland Dozier Holland. Are you with
me? But there was no A&R man like you either.
Exactly. Okay, so he, to change that, I thought was a mistake in my mind's eye.
Okay.
Line, it was necessary. So, it hurt, yes. Back to
okay.
you.
Now, let's get to the artists at Motown. Since you've worked with them all and you know them all. Diana Ross, diva! That's how the world sees her. That's how the press has named her, diva. Hard to get along with, very particular. However, things have come out recently in these books letting us know that maybe she looks and acts like a diva at times, but the one thing a lot of people don't know is that she was one of the hardest working people in Motown and worked harder than your average bear.
Yep.
What do you remember about her as far as her working extremely hard?
I remember that she wanted to get it right, and she wanted it to be a part of her. Whatever it was, be it a dance step, a movement, a speech, a look, a dress, a style, she wanted it to be right. She'll take it from the best, but now she wanted to be, let it be a part of her, so she had to add Diana Ross to it. That takes time, and I don't want to be a preacher, but the bottom line is this, and this is in music, and I guess in a lot of other fields, and talented people. When someone is showing you, and they're talented, and they are showing you something, or giving you something, or making you something, their talent, if you're picking the right person, is as good as what you do, sometimes even better, but they're talented in their field, and it behooves you to listen and deal with what they're bringing you. Now, that's one part. To keep your own personality and keep your identity, you now must or should deal with it in a way that your signature is on it. Now, that was a Diana Ross move, and a lot of other great people do that as well, but she's one. And like
okay.
Marvin would do it with a song, or Smokey would do it, or I'm sure great artists from Whitney would do it. It doesn't matter. They got to add their selves to that moment. Michael Jackson was good for doing the exact same thing. And that's very important. And she was like that. Now, that takes a lot of time and concentration. Not the gift brought to you, but to fix it where it's, you're part of it. That takes time and concentration and focus. She was that kind of person. And I said in my book in the beginning, you need some of these things to make you a superstar. You can have a gift from God as a voice. You can even be at the right place for somebody to give you a song. But when it comes down to focusing and steadfast and all that, that is a whole other ballgame. That's what makes stars. And she had that quality.
Okay. Marvin Gaye. very introspective, very complex individual. We all know he liked to get high. However, he was extremely talented. My mother used to call me Pudge. That was my little nickname. And one day we were watching television. We saw this old clip of Marvin Gaye. She said, Pudge, this doesn't sound right. He can sing. I said, what doesn't sound right? She said, listen. And he was trying to sing these Frank Sinatra-type songs. This is before I read the Motown books. I was a little girl, and he wanted to be a crooner. And so how were you all able to let him know that, look, Marvin, you're a great singer, you're a great artist, but this just isn't your forte?
Well, I go into a lot more detail in my book, as you know, but bottom line is, when Barry brought Marvin to me, and he said to me, okay, William R., I want a hit record for this guy. And I'm saying to him, okay, but he's a jazz singer, BG. He said, hey, man, I want a hit record. You got it. I was like a challenge at that point. I said, leave him with me. So Marvin said to me, can I call you Mickey? I said, yeah. Can I call you Marvin? He said, yeah. I said, okay, it's right there. We're going to be all right. So we shook hands. And I said to him, okay, man, I also hear you're a writer. And so let's do some songs together. You say, for who? I say, for different artists. We get to know each other. So that's how we started. Well, of course, I had a plan in my head. He didn't know it.
Right. And that plan happened to work, so.
Right. We started writing.
Yeah, and everybody can find out about the plan when they get the book. There is one group a lot of people don't ask people about, and I really want your perspective on this. How did you feel about the Marvelettes and the Velvelettes?
Well, I love them both because they had each group had a complete different personality and approach to music, which was absolutely amazing. And the Marvelettes was like feisty and hot, and the Velvelettes were like cool and smooth, and they kept that way throughout their whole career. They just, you knew the difference.
Wow. You know, some of the second tier groups, and I hate to use second tier because they were successful in their own right, but groups like, well, they're not second tier now, but at Motown, Gladys Knight and the Pips, the Elgins, groups like that, Bobby Taylor and the Vancouvers, where did they fit in at Motown? Because, you know, when you're talking about the Supremes, the Four Tops and Temptations, everybody, when they walk in the building, I'm sure they feel good about themselves, but the second tier groups, were they kind of like left to just go out on tour, or how did they relate to Motown, or how were they treated?
Well, let's see. Gladys Knight, a whole different ball game. They were. Idea was what songs. When you had producers writing like that, like we had working on the main acts. And I say main because they were there first, and they had hits, and we got to stay in business. The key was, can we get a hit on the next one?
Mm-hmm.
And we had hindsight, but we're glad she came from another label, I think. Yes, and we had to bring her in. We had to find something that would work for her. Same thing with the Isley Brothers. We had to find a moment, a way to make it happen. Song itself on Gladys, which was I heard it through the grapevine, I think was the number that did it with her. With us.
Mm-hmm.
Once it happened, they stepped in position in the upper group. They were always working someplace because they were known before we got them. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
The other ones, Elgins and people like that, they were. That's why I needed more producers, more writers, because I had to find writers that could work with the other act, while the main writers and producers were on the main act so that we could stay in business.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd find a writer or a producer that could come along and come up with a hit on the other artist, and so they would move into the second position. Now, whether they come up with a hit, and a lot of things happen with artists that are not mentioned. That is, they may start off as a group together, but then there's problems within the group, and they kind of slow down, and their is not 100%. This is not 100% with them there, but not really there. And where the other ones who stayed focused, they kept, you can always tell because those who stay focused, they in the end, they are still here. The ones that, they fall out along the way.
Right. Did you want to add anything to the, you're talking about people staying focused, and she was one of my favorite people in life as a fan, especially as a little girl. Did you want to add anything to the Florence Ballard saga, or everything that's been written has been written and there's nothing more to say?
There's nothing more to say. It is what it is.
Okay. I was just curious. Excuse me. What about the Andantes? It seemed like you had a thing for them. You really liked them. You claimed they were very professional and they, you know, added to the mix of the sound. Anything you want to say about them?
Yes, I love the Andantes because they were at my beck and call. And no matter what song I wanted them to do background on or sing with, they were right there. They would go in a room by themselves, take the tape, go in the back, hit it, work it out, step out, ready to do it. They were unbelievable. And they could sing any sound we wanted. They were like sisters who knew where the other one would go before they get there. That kind of feeling. And they were like magic. They were almost
wow.
And I about them being like a solo group and all that, it wasn't in the making for me. But to have them on everything, I mean, I couldn't go to sleep without get the girls and put them on. And then if we want to pull them up when they can be heard, great. If not, they become like an instrument. You know what I mean?
Right.
I love them to this very day.
James Jamerson. I almost cried, and I'm not just saying this. I almost cried when I read Jamerson was drinking and talking to you, and he said, I wish the general public had, you know, had known it was me playing the bass on those songs. And then you looked at him and said, well, I was doing my A&R thing, and I didn't think about this, and I wish I could have done more. And that's a really, you know, most people would have said, well, Jamerson, you had your time in the limelight, and that, but you totally agreed with him.
Yeah. And I it hurt me. I mean, I felt hurt. I mean, my heart, I felt heavy in my heart because just to think about it now, it bothers me. But I should have done all the guys. I mean, they brought their souls, you know. But I didn't know what to do. My mind wasn't in that. You see what I'm saying? My mind was making the company as great as I could deal with it, you know, deal with everybody. And if I'd have known that, I would have even made a for me. I mean, I would have made a better. If I knew that it was going to be what it turned out to be, I would plan better for myself. But I was in it, and that's what I would say to people. You know, this was God's doing, not mine. You know, I just did what I felt should happen. Doing that, some things I didn't pay attention to, and I really felt hurt about that. This very day, I felt hurt about that. But I see other guys.
Go
ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I was going to say, no, I'm sorry. But as a testament to your ability to pick out talent, excuse me, Benny Benjamin, I mean, come on, this guy, he could drink, but yet when it came time for the session, he knew exactly what to play.
That's what I'm saying. The guy was incredible. I mean, some of these people brought in because I was fortunate enough to find a Benny Benjamin who could play. All you had to do was get into the drum, sit in the seat. And you got to get him out of the seat. Once he sits down there, he's gone. Session after session, he would move.
You know, this is funny. Let me tell you, I hate to say this, but this was like one of the funniest parts of the book other than Martha. There is a Motown urban legend that the reason why you left Motown was to go to another label that offered you more money to get Kim Weston hits. We know that's not true, right?
Not true. Mm-hmm.
Okay. I always, for years and years, you know, when you read these Motown books, you never hear too much about Mickey Steele. You hear about Mickey, but you hear about Kim a little bit. But I had no idea that there was a 6'2" man or whomever that, I think he was a piano player, and Kim and him had something going. And the reason you guys broke up, because she he was going to blow his brains out in the car. And Kim said, "Oh, please don't do this, don't do this." And she was pleading with you for to leave so she could be with him. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah. It was love. It was in love. Oh, yeah. Love does strange things to people. You know what I mean? It has no limits to whoever. When it hits you, it hits you.
But that's one reason I want people who are Motown fans to get this book, because we had always been under the impression that you two left a label to go, you know, make a better life for yourself. And we had no idea that, you know, I was thinking to myself, oh, he's probably wants to leave Kim. But I had no idea that this is what happened. Do you two still talk or no? Or
yeah, we still talk. Yeah. When I left Motown, I left with her. We left together. All right.
Okay.
The relationship came later, you know, and that happens, you know. It was, I've had a few wives, as you can see, so obviously I didn't walk a straight line all the time, you know.
Right. I will say this, though, she did a wonderful job on It Takes Two with Marvin.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, her and Marvin Gaye, yeah, yeah. And she was, and is, a very, very emotional person. Kim was, say, a civil rights advocate.
Mm-hmm.
That's always in her head and in her mind, and she's always done that, and that's part of her makeup. That's what makes her who she is. I took a song called Lift Every Voice and Sing with Kim Weston and played it and had every radio station, black all over America, open and close with that song. Open and close with that station, with that song. And it was that she believed in that. When she left, we went to MDM, and then she wanted to be with Stax, with Al Bell, because Memphis at the time was having its own problems. And she loved the idea of going, making speeches and marching and a whole other ballgame. And I had to respect her for that. I had it for myself, but she was, like, in it. You know what I mean?
No, I know exactly what you mean. As a matter of fact, you're familiar with the West Coast version of the Funk Brothers. They're called the Wrecking Crew.
Yeah, I heard about it. Okay.
I was going to ask you, did you, you know, being at Motown, you were in Detroit a lot, but did you ever hook up with those guys, or did the Wrecking Crew ever talk to the Funk Brothers, or did that ever happen, or no, they were pretty much separate entities?
Separate entities, as far as I know, completely.
Okay. I was just curious about that. Do you still talk to Barney Ellis?
Yes. Barry had a party at on the Motown show at his house, and Barney was there. I would see Barney before that, but not for a while, and then I saw him again not too long ago at the party. And he was the same Barney, never changed. He was opening up, "All right, William R., where's this, where's that, and where's my 10% of that song I did?"
You know what I find interesting, especially, and I haven't brought him up, I'll bring him up now, Smokey Robinson. For him to have written as many hits as he's written, he seems to be a very humble individual. Is that true in real life?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Absolutely humble. And he's a giver. And he aches when people are in pain for them. He's an amazing guy. He's one of the only artists. And we have some other ones at Motown, but he's one of the only artists that I know of, and I know I've been seen with every act there is practically,
mm-hmm.
that will stay at the end of a show, sign every autograph, every picture, no matter how long it takes. Amazing. And one day I said to him, I said, "Are we supposed to play golf the next morning?" I said, "Man, what do you got to?" He said, "William R., if it wasn't for these people, I wouldn't be here. Everything that I can do." And he meant every word of that. To this very day, I have him now in a couple of places. I got him in Birmingham for the civil rights.
Mm-hmm.
He's opening there on the 22nd.
Mm-hmm.
He loves I'm going. And working with World Peace, a place for soldiers. He's performing there in St. Louis, Missouri. He loves the idea of doing that, giving back. He's always been that way to this very day. And I said, "Man, God has definitely got you here for a reason." And, you know, Smokey would go into a church, pay his money to fly to your church and speak.
Wow.
Not you don't pay him. if he knows that this, he can get the word of the Lord to these people, he will go on his own. He's been doing that for years. People don't know that, but I'm letting you know. He will go on his own, pay his way, make his speech, tell the people what they need to hear for the Lord, mind you, and fly back, and then go to another job. Now,
that's incredible.
Is that incredible? And it makes you feel humble. It makes you say, and when I see other artists, I say, who do you think you are? God gave you this opportunity to be great and to say things to help others, and you close the door and go to your room or don't want to talk to nobody, or you act like you made yourself. You didn't do that. Who do you think you are?
What do you want us to know about Barry? What do you? I have to ask you this. What do you want us to know about Barry Gordy that a lot of people don't know?
That he is giver of his, the gift that was given to him. He passes it on.
Okay.
And that's a tough one. And yes, it paid off for him. It was for a reason. I tell everybody, I think I even said in my book, it was Barry Gordy's dream, but it was God's plan.
Wow. That's a great way of putting it.
Yeah.
And I want you, if you get the chance, and I know this is a big request, but if you ever get a chance, tell Barry Gordy that Stephanie Campbell said that we Motown fans want a book on sessions and studio time. And I think you know what I mean by that, like the logs, if they still exist.
Yes.
Because there's a big demand for that. People, I think that would make a great coffee table book to have the logs and the studio sessions and what happened during, you know, even if he has any film that exists with talking, I think we would love to see something like that. But, again, I know that's at the bottom of his tree of things to do, but there is a wanting for that.
I like that idea. I think I'll take that up myself and see that it happens. Interesting.
I will personally fly out and shake his hand if that's something that he would like to do or you would like. I mean, because I know for a fact, you know, he might be sitting back thinking to himself, oh, nobody cares about that. But we really do. Even people who aren't Motown fans who are into recording, I really think a coffee table book with the sessions, the logs, even a documentary, I think that's a great idea. And I know he's got those things. He must have them. He must.
That is a good idea. I have a bunch of that myself. That's interesting.
Imagine, well, good. We want it from Mickey Stevenson then. Because of you, the hits just kept on coming.
Yeah.
Motown 25.
Motown,
were you there?
Yes. It was great. It was a wonderful moment. Everybody came back at his request. And we were all with different companies and everything. But
mm-hmm.
We all did that to each other to come together, which was a wonderful. And with no resistance, we all showed up. And it was fantastic. And I got to tell you, which was very felt good for me, and I think that might have been on a different footage, but we were at the piano table talking. All the producers that I had brought to the company and the writers, they were there, and they had the same feeling of respect for me, was as if I'd never left the moment. That was incredible.
Wow, that's incredible. Why did you, Mickey, there's so much in this book that we haven't even talked about, and that's why people really need to buy it, because there's tons of stories like that we've spoken about right now. But what did you say, oh, it's my turn, or did you write the book because you wanted people to know what an AR man did, or I want to make a little more money? What was your reason for writing this book? Because it's very good.
My daughters, they wanted to know how did it happen, and my sons, and they say, well, Dad, how'd you do that? I mean, what you know, we know about smoking, we know about Holland Doge and all that, but how'd you do that? And I think that kind of got me rolling into it. So I decided if I'm going to write a book, let me tell it, no flowers, right to the point. I read everybody else's book, and I said, okay, but I don't want to.
Well, write without mentioning any names or any of the authors of the other books, what percentage of those books would you say, through their eyes, is 100% true?
I would say from their point of view, because a lot of the things the artists knew nothing about. They just did songs, so they could only talk about what they were in. Are you following me? They were not in the whole mix of the record. They were just singing. So it's like they were in the company, but they didn't know what made it function, how the records got on, how they got off, when they went on, what was paid, what was not done, what unions, what they did. They had no idea of this stuff. All they knew is they came in and made an audition. They got a chance to be produced by a Holland Dozier or a Smokey or a Stevenson or somebody. But the functions of making a company work, and especially a Motown, was a whole other ballgame. I'm saying that to say they wrote from their own thoughts and their position. They could not include Nine Yards because they had no knowledge.
Okay, so if a Martha Reeves or a Mary Wilson says, Barry owes us money, ignorant to the fact of how much money was spent on them in honing their craft?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And so that brings us to the chapter in your book, and I don't remember the exact name of the chapter, but you debunked the theory that Barry didn't pay everybody. You said that's a lie. It's not true.
Right. Yeah, he paid. Now, whether you think you deserve more is because you're hearing I sold a million records. Well, you know, there were so many given away. So many was packaged and double price. You buy this, get that. Barney had to make deals on everything. There was no way in those days that it just went out the door like that, especially a black company. Forget it. All the major distributors were white. You think they're going to do it? Come on. They don't do it now with your house. No, they weren't doing it with records.
I will tell you something interesting that it wasn't in your book, but it was kind of inferred in your book. Motown, even with people who weren't making hits, Barry still kept them on the payroll.
Exactly. And not only that, forget the hits. If they had a job with the company, he couldn't fire them. I said, look, BG, come on, man, this guy is not functioning. He said, well, I'm putting him in your department. You figure out something for me. Now, he couldn't fire him. I could fire you, but he couldn't fire them. He wouldn't do it. He wouldn't do it.
That's interesting you say that, because as an A&R man, it should have been just your job just to hire the acts and the musicians and put them with the producers, like you said. But anytime somebody had a problem, go to Mickey. Coffee machine's not working. Go to Mickey.
I mean, I was there, and I would find a solution. You know what I mean? I learned that, you know, I through a period of time, I was here for a reason. The gift, thank God, in writing and producing or finding talent, that's one thing. But to deal with the people, to hold them together, was another.
That's a hard job.
Yes, yes. And I worked 24 hours a day. I loved it. That's another thing. I guess that's why I kept changing wax. That was my other woman. You know what I mean?
No, I understand. And you love both of them. But you know what I want to do? Let's talk about, because we've only got 10 minutes left. I want to know, other than the book. Oh, and by the way, Motown's First A&R Man presents The A&R Man by William Mickey Stevenson, can be bought at most bookstores and Amazon and Barnes & Noble. What are you doing right now in your life, other than going on book signings?
Okay, I do shows, plays. I've had five musical plays. I've won like 15 awards from the NAACP as a playwright and producer, and I'm coming out with a couple now that I'm working on, and I take like a Smokey, and I'm working with Aretha and a few others, and I'm working with organizations like World Peace One and the soldiers, you know, that's been left behind. I hate to hear 50,000 soldiers with no place to live. I my heart's still there, and I do these things, and I'm having a lot of fun and making things happen. And like I say, I got a show going in Alabama on the 21st. I got one in be on the 6th, and we're bringing in like 2,000 and 3,000 people to help these organizations. And like I do plays and shows and looking mm-hmm. for someone to turn my book into a movie. We're dealing with that.
Oh. Well, I remember I was flipping channels one day. This must have been about a year ago. And I looked. I'm like, oh, this is Mickey Stevenson and Smokey. And I didn't really delve into it. Is that one of the plays that where you and him had a play on Broadway or something?
No, no. We had one in New York, but not on Broadway.
In New York. I'm sorry. Yeah.
The one on Broadway, of course, is the Motown show. The only show that's happening, Motown the Musical on Broadway. But I'm coming. I'm coming on Broadway with Saying It From the Heart, Billie Holiday, Josephine Baker, Dinah Washington, Mahalia Jackson, Bessie Smith, Dorothy Vander, it, and Lena Horne. They all come to in an incredible musical called Sing It From the Heart. Watch that.
Wow, and I'm assuming that if we want to learn more about that, do we just go to Facebook, or is there a particular site we should go to, or that's being built, or...
We're working on the show now, auditioning and mounting and all that sort of thing. So it'll be a little while before it's finished. But when it's finished, it'll be out. Everybody will know about it.
Oh, wow. That ought to be interesting. It's almost like you've had second, third, and fourth chances. I mean, you've been involved with a lot of things that the general public doesn't even know about.
Oh, boy. I got to tell you, when I did this show, I wrote a song about 8 years ago called Put a Woman in the White House Today. Guess what?
Okay.
Isn't that amazing?
Wow.
What's happening now?
And again, you know, have you ever had people who are A&R people in later years who knew about you and asked you questions like, how do I do this? Or how would you do this?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. They call. And by the way, my son has just been made, one of my sons, Novo, who's just been made the A&R director for a company in Atlanta.
And oh, wow.
Dad, now what do I do about this? What do I do about that?
You know, that's kind of interesting about your story, and this is, yeah, I'm plugging. The reason why people should buy this book is because no one taught you how to be an A&R man. You were literally thrown into this, and I think you defined the criteria for what an A&R man should do.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I say this was all God's doing. Right now, when I'm in a strange place. Right now, my son Novel, who set this up, this conversation, he's like telling me what to do. I have to listen now. On what got me in a strange place. I've been telling people what to do all my life. Now I got to listen.
You know, when I talk to your son, is your whole family like this shoot from the hip type, or did they learn this from you?
I got to know. Brian, did you learn it from me?
Yeah.
Yes, he learned it from me. Yeah. He learned it from me,
I mean,
and I learned it
you
from
know, I'm just curious, and I told your son I was going to ask you this question. This, all these books that are written about Motown, to your knowledge, does Barry read these books, or does he comment on them, or does he say, oh, it's just another book?
I have no idea. I don't know if he sits down. It's a lot of books, and I've read mostly all of them, because which let me know what I didn't want to write about. So
right.
I don't know where he's at with that. I can't answer that question.
Because if someone wrote a book about me, I'd read every one of them just to say, I wonder what they said or what they know. And I mean, but then again, I know he has other fish to fry. But I think if someone wrote a book about me, I'd like to read it and see what their thoughts were.
Well, if you knew the person, then what would you think? Or you still want to know what they said, huh?
Well, yeah, I guess so. Has he read your book?
I have no idea.
Well, you're still talking. You guys are still friends, so.
Oh, yeah. I haven't.
But you didn't say anything really horrible about him. I mean, it's not like you put anything in here that would, you know, break off.
No, he knows I'll tell the truth. He knows that. He knows how I am. I didn't run his company for years, and that sticks to the facts. I got a documentary called The A&R Man. That's out. And he was one of the first people that stand on the documentary that said that Mickey Stevenson did this, the greatest A&R man ever. And he helped make this company what it is. He said these words.
And you didn't tell him to say this either?
Nope. I didn't even know he was going to show up. I looked
wow.
up and there he was, and they gave me an award at the Black Institute Museum, and he was there. I didn't even know he was going to be there. I looked up, and there he was on the stage. He says, "I'm here for you." And he started talking for about 25 minutes, and it was amazing. Here's to my eyes. I had no idea that other things and how he really felt, because we never had that kind of. And Smokey was there as well, and they both stood and set my documentary in motion.
Wow. Is it still being done, or it's done already?
I'm going to send you an excerpt from it. I'm going to make sure you get it.
Oh, I appreciate that.
And you can edit, run it, whatever you like. I'll send you a few minutes of it. I left Atlanta, Georgia last week in the film festival, and it was nominated for an award there. I did not win. I lost to a documentary about some Africans with one leg on crutches playing ball, kick, what is it called? Soccer. It was the most incredible thing I had ever seen. The guy would kick the ball, and his leg would be so high in the air, and his crutches so far in the back, it looked like he was flying. And they were incredible, all of them, one leg. And I said, "You deserve number one. I'll wait till the next come around. I'll get number one the next time." In my heart, I was glad that they won. Now, that's how I am.
You're an energy giver. You're not jealous.
Yeah, I loved it. To see that was just amazing.
To see that someone would even make a documentary like that.
Isn't that amazing, though?
It's totally amazing, totally. And this book, Motown's First A&R Man, presents the A&R Man by William Mickey Stevenson, is great also. And I'm so glad to see that it's transcribed by your daughter.
Oh, yeah, she was. She didn't fool around. She said, "Dad, you got to tell them, like tell the truth. Yeah, get on them. They need to know." So I would be right.
Yeah, Mickey, it must feel good waking up in the morning and going to bed at night knowing that you, not being, self-promotional, although that's kind of an ironic term, self-promotional, but, knowing who you are and what you've done, it must feel, you can sleep at night knowing that you brought a lot of joy into people's lives.
Well, I can, because when they bring it back to me, some people have walked up to me and said, "Man, I just want to thank you, because remember that time when I met you that I cannot remember any of that. All I know is if someone had the opportunity to stop me and I caught my attention, whatever I could do to help them, I would do. And I would just walk away after I did it." And that's all I thought of. And see this come back. I was more shocked when I an opening for my documentary, the video, the A&R Man, the video.
Mm-hmm.
I invited a few people, like 100, over 600 people. So, where did people
come? My goodness.
And they all knew who I was. I didn't know who they were. And they were talking that. So I did a couple of moments of after the documentary. And as a matter of fact, I had to tell everybody, I had to stop. I didn't pay for this theater for this kind of, for this to go this far. Y'all got to get out of here. So that warms my heart.
And I've got 90 seconds left, Mickey, and I wish I could keep you on the phone. Number one, I've got to thank Jay Lowry for this, because without him, this interview could not have happened. Number two, again, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, maybe the library, Motown's First A&R Man presents The A&R Man by William Mickey Stevenson. Mickey, I have got to thank you for this interview. As a child, I read your name, and as an adult, I speak your name. And again, I want to thank you so much for gracing the telephone, which is a microphone in this case, and I'm going to keep promoting the book. Don't think that just because we're not talking anymore that I'm not going to keep promoting the book. Okay?
Oh, I love it. Thank you very, very much.
You check out my Facebook, and you'll see nothing but William Mickey Stevenson, and I'll check out your Facebook, and I'll see William Mickey Stevenson, not just the book, but all of your happenings from point A to point Z. And we're going to talk again. I'm sure we are. And don't forget to send me the clip of that documentary so I can be a Motown fanatic and be a fan and go, "Yes, I talked to William Mickey Stevenson. Your book will be promoted. My friends will buy it. And not only that, we'll cherish it and we'll revel in the Motown magic."
Thank you. Thank you. And God bless you.
God bless you. And I hope you have a wonderful night. We'll talk soon. Okay.
Okay.
Bye, Mickey.
Bye-bye.
Bye.